You can take your Bibles, open them this morning to the 15th chapter of the Gospel of Mark. Mark chapter 15. For just over 1 year, we have been walking with Jesus through the Gospel of Mark. And this morning, we reach the climax of the Gospel of Mark. It's very early Friday morning of Passover week. The sun is about to rise. Within the past few hours, Jesus has been deserted by his disciples, condemned to death by the Jewish authorities, and disowned three times by Peter, the leader of his men. Mark 15, verse 1. And as soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. And they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate. It's the break of dawn. Jesus is bound and handed over to Pilate for trial. Roman officials, it might sound early, but Roman officials often began their workday at dawn. This seems to be the case for Pilate as well. At daybreak, Jesus is brought to him. Remember, the night before, he's already been tried by the Jewish authorities in the middle of the night. Pilate is the Roman governor over this region. He's not typically in Jerusalem. That's not where he lives. But he is there today because it's Passover week. It's Pilate's main job to do whatever it takes to keep peace in the region. And so at any festival, he's in Jerusalem to keep watch on the people. He always has to make sure Rome is happy with him. But the only way to keep Rome happy is if he keeps the Jews under control, especially in Jerusalem, especially at the festivals. And you have to remember, the Jewish authorities, yeah, they have condemned Jesus to die, but they have no authority to put him to death. Only Pilate has the authority in this region to put someone to death. So they have to bring Jesus to him. Verse 2, and Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" See, Mark cuts the trial scene very short and brings us right to the central issue. See, Pilate didn't really care about charges of blasphemy, religious squabbles between the Jews. He doesn't care about that kind of stuff. The Jewish leaders know that. So they have to bring charges that Pilate might care about, right? They have to show that Jesus is somehow a threat to Rome. That's the only reason he's going to put him to death. So what do they tell Pilate? Perhaps the main thing that they claim is that Jesus is claiming to be the king. He's claiming to be the king of the Jews. That's why Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Verse 2 again, and Jesus answers him, "You have said so." Now, what does that mean? Have you ever wondered that before if you've read this text? I mean, what exactly is Jesus saying? "Are you the king of the Jews? You've said so." Is that a yes, a no, something in between? The best explanation is probably that Jesus is saying something like, "It's like you say, but not in the way you're thinking." Or something like, "Yes, I am, but my kingdom or kingship is different than what you're thinking when you ask me that question." Now, verse 3, and the chief priest accused him of many things. They got all kinds of stuff they don't like about Jesus. And Pilate again asked him, "Have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you." But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. So the Jews, they bring charges probably like what Jesus has said about the temple. He said he's going to destroy it. The Gospel of Luke tells us that they accused Jesus of teaching people not to pay taxes to Caesar. They try to bring out everything that they think would be relevant to Pilate. Pilate listens to all of it. And what does he notice about Jesus? Jesus never defends himself. He never says anything to any of the charges brought against him. So he just asks him, aren't you going to say something? What are they talking about? And Jesus won't say anything. And so Pilate's amazed. That's the end of the first scene of the trial. Now in verse 6, Mark wants to help us get familiar with a practice that maybe we're not familiar with. We wouldn't have known about unless Mark told us. So verse 6, Mark adds, now at the feast, at Passover, Pilate used to release for them one prisoner for whom they asked. Now we might think, oh, that sounds nice. Pilate's such a nice guy, you know? Passover, release somebody from prison. But I think it's safe to say that what Pilate was doing was very politically motivated. I mean, after all, it's Passover, and what are the Jews remembering at Passover? How God has set us free from our, you know, captors and so forth. So it's a rough time to be a Roman governor in Jerusalem at Passover when the Roman people oppress the Jewish people and they're all remembering of how God has set them free in the past. So this is one thing that he does to try to make them, you know, get a little bit on his good side. You know, I'll pick one of your random prisoners that I could kill and I'll let him go for you. Maybe I'll help you out. So verse 7. So Mark tells us that that's something that was going on at this time. So then verse 7. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection, in like the revolt, probably against Rome, there was a man called Barabbas. And the crowd came up. Okay, because probably Pilate is Jesus is before Pilate and it's outside the palace. It's somewhere where you could have people coming up and seeing what's happening. And so it says, and the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them, because it's the Friday of Passover week, it's in the morning, and so they come and they say, do the let the prisoner go thing for us. And Pilate answered them, saying, do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews? Who's right there in front of him. Because Pilate perceived, verse 10 says, that it was out of envy that the chief priest had delivered Jesus up. So can you picture what's going on? It's pretty clear by this point that Pilate has a pretty good idea of what this whole trial is about. This isn't really a trial about Jesus being a big threat to Rome, I think is what Pilate has realized. He senses the envy and the hatred of the Jewish leaders for Jesus, and that they are trying to use him to put Jesus to death, because he knows they can't do it. So they're trying to use him to put Jesus to death. So seemingly during this trial, you got these people from the crowd, they come up, they say, do the prisoner release thing. And Pilate, what do you think he might think in that? As they ask him, and Jesus is right there, he realizes the leaders just want to put Jesus to death. Seems like a very convenient coincidence, probably, for Pilate, that this is happening at the same time. Because what does he probably conclude, you know? Jesus, he knows he's a popular teacher, healer. If I offer them Jesus, the people will pick Jesus. The religious authorities can't say anything about it. Everybody is fine. Verse 11. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release for them Barabbas instead. And Pilate again said to them, then what shall I do with the man you call the King of the Jews? And they cried out again, crucify him. And Pilate said to them, why? What evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, crucify him. So Pilate wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Like so many things in Mark, this all happens very, very fast in the story. The chief priests stir up the crowds to pick Barabbas. This probably stuns Pilate. He did not see that coming. Well, then what do you want me to do with the king of the Jews? Crucify him. Why? For what? They just shout louder and louder, crucify him. Pilate sees he's getting nowhere. So to keep the peace and really to protect himself, because that's what it's all about, he goes along with it. He releases Barabbas, scourges Jesus, hands Jesus over to the execution squad. Two things before we move on from there. And one, you think of Barabbas for a second. I mean, he is likely scheduled to be tried for murder and sentenced this very morning. He is a clear criminal, a murderer, a revolutionary. And yet here, at the last minute, he is released while Jesus is condemned. Second, Mark says something so quickly that we might have missed it. Pilate has Jesus scourged before handing him over to be crucified. What does that mean, that Jesus was scourged? Now, on the one hand, if you read Mark and all of the gospel accounts, the writers rarely focus on how brutally Jesus is treated. We're not going to dwell on it that much today either. Yet at the same time, there's a difference, though, we have to realize between us and the readers. We have to realize that the Roman readers didn't need a lot of details. They knew what happened to criminals. So when it says Pilate scourged him and then released him, they know what happened, and we might not even grasp what was going on. When Pilate has Jesus scourged, this was a horrific thing. Scourging at this time was the thing that was designed to prepare the criminals for being crucified, for execution. The scourging itself was so brutal that sometimes prisoners would die just from the scourging and they would never get to the cross. The Romans would strip the prisoner, tie their hands to a post, and then take a whip with shards of bone, lead, or glass, and they would whip the prisoner mercilessly. No limit to it for the Romans. Tearing their skin, even muscles, to shreds. Having scourged Jesus, Pilate hands him over to be crucified. He's now handed over to those who are actually going to carry it out. Now we might think, okay, they're just going to leave from there to go to the execution spot. But they don't. They have something they want to do with Jesus first. Verse 16. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace. That is the governor's headquarters. And they called together the whole battalion. Did you see that? And they're probably on the exterior of this place where Pilate's like sitting in judgment so that the others can, people can see and hear what's going on. But when he hands them over, they actually don't lead him out. They lead him in, further in to the palace, maybe into one of the courtyards inside the palace. Why? What do they want to do in there? Apparently, those who had witnessed the trial outside had heard the charges about the king of the Jews. They had perhaps even done the scourging themselves. They lead Jesus back inside and they call together all their soldier friends. The whole battalion. We're probably talking about a few hundred soldiers coming together into the palace, maybe into the courtyard, to see the king. What are they going to do? Verse 17. And they clothed him in a purple cloak. Maybe like grab an old soldier's cloak, put it around him. They twist together a crown of thorns. You know, grab some thorn branches, weave them together a bit, put it on his head. Verse 18. And they began to salute him. Hail, King of the Jews! And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak, put his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. And can you imagine a couple hundred soldiers doing this? They want to, see, what did they want to do? They want to honor the King of the Jews. So they grab the cloak, put it on him like a royal robe. We got a crown for you. They crown him king. Now that he's all dressed up, Matthew tells us they actually put the stick first in his right hand, like a ruling scepter. All dressed up like a king, they start saying, Hail, King of the Jews! Someone grabs the stick out of his hand, starts beating him on the head. Some start spitting in his face. Some are kneeling down before the king. When they've had their fun, they strip off the royal robes, put his clothes back on him, and they lead him away to finish the job. Verse 21. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. All right, the chief instrument of humiliation and of Roman domination was the cross. Everything about it was designed to humiliate. And one of the many ways to humiliate the one to be crucified was to make him carry his own crossbeam to the spot where he would be killed. Now, the upright pole for a Roman cross was already there at the execution spot, sunk into the ground. But the criminal would carry the heavy crossbeam. So it's probably there around Pilate's place. Pick it up, and then they would walk them and parade them down popular streets. This isn't happening in private places. The Romans want everybody to see. Jesus starts to carry it, but he's so tired. He's so weary. He's been beaten throughout the night, all night trials. He's so wounded now from the scourging. I mean, he'd be bleeding everywhere. Jesus can't carry it any further. The soldiers grab a random person coming into the city from the countryside. They force him to carry the cross the rest of the way. Mark adds that this guy, Simon of Cyrene, was the father of Alexander and Rufus. You know, why does he say that? It would seem like the Roman churches that Mark seems to be writing to in his day must have known those guys. Or else I don't know why Mark would have mentioned that. Interestingly, Paul writes a letter to the Romans around this time, maybe shortly before the Gospel of Mark, and he sends greetings specifically to Rufus and to his mother, very possibly the same guy. In any event, this otherwise unknown man, Simon of Cyrene, carries the crossbeam the rest of the way for Jesus. Verse 22. And they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered Jesus wine mixed with myrrh, but he didn't take it. And they crucified him. So they bring him to the spot. The wine with myrrh. We're not sure why they do that. Was that like an act of kindness to dull the pain? Maybe an act of mockery. Give the king a cup of wine before you nail him to the cross. Jesus doesn't take it either way. And then Mark says, and they crucified him. Again, Mark's not going to focus on the details of it. No Roman reader needs the details. But we might need to know a little bit. When they get to the spot, the criminal would lay down the crossbeam that he's carried. It would probably be near, lay it down near the upright pole that's already there. They would then strip the criminal, typically of all of his clothing. Sometimes for Jews, maybe leave a loincloth, but very likely they strip them of all their clothing. The criminal would then be forced to lie down, stretch out his arms on the crossbeam that he carried. And then they would either nail him or tie his hands or wrists to the crossbeam. In Jesus' case, they nail him to it, probably through the wrists. They then lift that crossbeam up with him attached to it, and they attach it to the upright pole. Then they nail the feet to the pole, maybe on both sides, maybe one through both feet. In a lot of cases, there was some sort of small seat or block of wood in the middle of the upright pole so that the criminal's weight could be partially offset on the seat. This was not to show mercy. If anything, it was to prolong the torture. Crucifixion was not supposed to be fast. It was designed to be long, public, and shameful. They would do it by a popular street to make sure all kinds of people would be able to walk by and see. This is what happened to Jesus. Roman readers all knew. Verse 24. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour, or about 9 a.m., when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, this is something they would put up on top, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers or rebels, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he can't save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." And those who were crucified with him also reviled him. Within about 12 hours, Jesus has gone from leaving the city as a free man, sharing the Passover meal with his disciples, maybe 12 hours or so before this, to hanging on a cross. Again, Mark hardly focuses on the physical torment of the cross. Instead, he comments on all the things happening around the cross. The soldiers who oversee the execution, and they do this with all of the executions, they have a right to claim whatever little stuff the criminals had on them. They do the same thing for Jesus. They strip Jesus of his clothes before putting him on the cross. Then as he hangs there suffering, they play a game. They cast lots, sort of like rolling dice, to see which part of his clothes each of them is going to be able to take home. They have no idea, I'm sure, that Psalm 22, which we read this morning, says this: "They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." Criminals would often have a brief summary of the charge put at the top of the crossbeam. Pilate chooses it. For this guy, he says, "The King of the Jews." Criminals, or next to each side of Jesus, or next to Jesus on each side, there are two other criminals being executed, most likely for revolution or insurrection. They mock Jesus too. In all likelihood, these were two partners with Barabbas. You see, all three of them were probably supposed to be tried and killed this day. But Barabbas is somewhere else, completely free. Jesus hangs there in his place. Those passing by on the streets, just outside the city walls, shake their heads. They wag their heads. We read that in Psalm 22. They mock Jesus. "Aha, you who would destroy the temple, rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself." The chief priests don't want to miss their opportunity because this is their like crowning moment. So they join in. He saved others, he can't save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross so we can see it and then we'll believe. Hours go by. It's now high noon, the brightest part of the day. Verse 33. And when the sixth hour, about noon, when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, about 3 p.m. This is not simply an eclipse, which certainly wouldn't last 3 hours. We don't know what exactly happened, but at the brightest portion of the day, the sun no longer shines. This is a time of darkness. In a phrase that sounds really similar to the ninth plague in Exodus, Mark says, there was darkness over the whole land for 3 hours. Mark says nothing else about what happened during those 3 hours. It seems like it was all dark. It was all quiet. But as the darkness lifts, around 3 p.m., Friday afternoon, Jesus' voice breaks through the silence as he shouts out his only words in Mark's account. Verse 34, and at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. That is an Aramaic phrase, so Mark tells his Roman readers what it means, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders hearing it said, behold, he's calling Elijah. See, they probably don't understand exactly what he said. But the Aramaic words, Eloi, Eloi, sound enough like Elijah, Elijah. Some of them conclude, he's trying to call for Elijah to come. So someone runs in verse 36 and fills a sponge with sour wine, puts it on a reed, on a stick, because he's hanging up a little bit high. And he lifts it up to give him this to drink, saying, wait, now let's see whether Elijah will come to take him down. But they have not understood what Jesus said. Jesus was not calling for Elijah. Certainly not calling for somebody to come and take him down. Jesus was quoting the Bible. He was crying out the cry of despair. Psalm 22, verse 1. My God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus was betrayed by Judas, abandoned by his disciples, denied by Peter, rejected by the Jewish leadership, condemned to die by the Romans, mocked by just about everyone and in just about every way. But there is no doubt that this is the greatest horror of the cross, to be forsaken by God. In the opening verses of Mark, we heard God say to Jesus, you are my son, whom I love. I am so happy with you. Now on the cross, Jesus experiences something he has never experienced before. He is abandoned by his Father. It's a mystery to us, something we'll never fully grasp, how God turns his back on Jesus and strikes his son. Why? Jesus, to use I think Mark's language, is drinking down the cup of suffering, the cup of divine wrath for us. This cup is the new covenant in his blood. And he's drinking it down to the last drop. In the words of Jesus, he's offering up his life as a ransom for many. In the words of Isaiah, the Lord is laying on him the sins of us all. Or in the words of Paul, God is making him who knew no sin to be sin for us and is striking him for us. Now we come to verse 37. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. With all his strength, he shouts out one more time. It probably shocked all the people who were there, including the guys who had witnessed so many of these crucifixions, that he has the strength to shout out, and then he just lets his last breath out, and it's all over. So fast for crucifixion. And he's dead. Now, we might think Mark would stop there, but he doesn't. Two things happen when Jesus dies that Mark wants us not to miss. Verse 38, one happens back inside the city walls. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Mark offers no comment on how that happened, but if a huge, thick curtain was torn in two from top to bottom, it is clearly an act of God. Mark also offers no comment on why it happened. He wants you to think about it. What does it mean? What is God saying through ripping apart the veil? I think it's safe to say that at least two things are being communicated. One is that the work that's been going on in that temple for hundreds of years is no longer needed. The tearing of the veil is a sign that the work in the temple, especially the constant shedding of the blood of innocent animals for the sins of human beings, is over. What has happened on the cross outside the city walls has made all of that unnecessary. And second, it would communicate, at least I think, that the door to God, to being near Him, to approaching God, has been flung wide open. The curtain has been torn open. Come to God through Jesus. The path is wide open for all who want to come. What happened on the cross opened the door for all to come to God through Jesus. But there's one more thing that happens when Jesus dies. It happens right there on that hill, right in front of Jesus. Verse 39, and when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. That is the very first time in Mark that anybody sees it. In Mark 1:1, the very first verse of this book, Mark tells all the readers, I'm going to tell you the beginning of the good news of Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. A few verses later, in chapter 1, we hear a voice from heaven say, you are my Son. We see every demon, it seems like, knows exactly who Jesus is, that he's the Son of God. But there's not one single human character in the Gospel of Mark who ever sees it until that Roman soldier who's standing face to face with Jesus, looking at him dead on the cross. He finally sees it. That guy is the Son of God. When we think that Mark was likely written to Roman believers, we can only imagine the impact of the Roman centurion's confession on them. The first one to confess Jesus as the Son of God was the Roman centurion who oversaw the execution and humiliation of the Son of God. As we close today, I hope you've seen Jesus vividly portrayed as crucified. And I hope God is opening your eyes to see Jesus, who he is, and what he's done for you. But I want to think specifically about two things that those chief priests said about Jesus, to Jesus, as they were mocking him. One, they say, he saved others. He cannot save himself. There's a lot of irony in what they're saying. Because the truth is that Jesus can only save others by not saving himself. Jesus stayed there on that cross specifically to save others. Do you see that? That Jesus died for you. They thought he could not come down. They mock him. He loved you to the end. No one loves you like Jesus. Do you see that? Second, they mocked Jesus by saying this: let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross so we can see it and believe. In other words, they're saying something like this: Jesus, I would believe that you are the Christ if you would get off the cross. But here's the thing. When does somebody finally see the truth about Jesus? It's when the centurion sees him dying and still hanging on the cross. They say, I would believe if you would get off of it. But the truth is, you will only come to grips with who Jesus is, with who you are, and with what Jesus came to do for us, is if you see him on the cross. It's in the cross that we find out who Jesus really is. That we see what he's really like. There is no saving knowledge of Jesus without the cross. A Jesus without the cross is not the Jesus of the Bible. There are lots of people that think Jesus is some really great guy, even a great prophet. But Jesus without the cross is not the Jesus of the Bible. It is a false Jesus. You can't know Jesus apart from seeing him on the cross. There's no Christ worth hearing about if not Christ crucified. That is why we preach Christ crucified. It's only through the cross that we come to see Jesus for who he is, the Son of God slain for us. Do you see him today as that? Will you confess your allegiance to a man like that? Will you, in Jesus' own words, renounce your claim on your life, pick up a cross, and get behind him? Let's pray. Father, help us. Show us Christ through the preaching of this word. Show us Christ in and through the cross. And we thank you, Lord Jesus, that you still hear our prayers today, because we know you are not dead. You're alive forevermore. We worship you. You are the King. Thank you for saving us. Amen.